Good evening, and on behalf of the Dean and Chapter, a very warm welcome to you here to the Lady Chapel in Westminster Abbey. A very brief word about the space that you've been enjoying, I hope, as you've been waiting. Do cast your eyes up to the fan vaulting from the early 16th century. The tomb of Henry VII and Elizabeth of York lies behind me, tomb created by Torrigiano, and now the home of the Order of the Bath, which are the banners that you can see around it. One fascinating little snippet about the end is that Oliver Cromwell has a little plaque that says that he was buried here between 1658 and 1661, but no longer as he was dug up. May I also welcome you to the Abbey Institute and this series on going to war. The Abbey has been founding and offering hospitality to the Institute as a sign of our faith in public life, as a force for good, rooted in the Abbey's resources of spirituality and scholarship. Claire Foster Gilbert is our director here on the front row, and it's something that I have the pleasure of chairing. During this autumn series, we have been going through a number of occasions looking at going to war, not least William Hague speaking last week on humanizing hell. We have meetings with members of the armed forces, politicians, many different groups, and we're delighted today to be welcoming our two guest speakers. But first, may I introduce Mark Easton, who is going to be chairing tonight. He is the BBC Home Editor. Mark, a delight to see you. Author of Britain, Etc. in 2012, a renowned blogger, and recently hot foot from a Union Jack mini going around the country, which we'll hear more about next week, I hope. Mark is a member of our Council of Reference, and would you welcome him very warmly.
Thank you. Thank you very much indeed, Andrew. So our title tonight is Good War, Bad War? Moral Reflections on 1914 and Beyond. Now, a centenary, it seems to me, is an important moment for reflection. It's an anniversary that sees an event move from the realm of the contemporary and into history. Those with direct experience have all but gone. Their voices become archive. In 1964, when Britain also reflected on the start of the First World War, I was 5 years old, too young to have engaged much with the 50th anniversary, but the character of that period of reflection shaped me and my generation's view and understanding of World War I. In the mid-70s, my school play was Oh, What a Lovely War, the Joan Littlewood musical originally produced for the Theatre Royal Stratford East back in 1963. I played the narrator, telling a deeply poignant story of innocent, brave young Tommies pointlessly led to slaughter in the mud of the trenches by vainglorious and reckless commanders. Like many of my generation at school, English classes included study of the war poets, notably Wilfred Owen's Dulce et Decorum Est, Gas, Gas, Quick Boys, An Ecstasy of Fumbling. The lines stayed with me like the clinging mustard gas of the trenches. Our history lessons echoed the sentiment. The crop of teachers who attempted to help us understand the conflict had been weaned on Alan Clark and A.J.B. Taylor. The image of lions led by donkeys had left a deep imprint on the staff, and from then them onto their pupils. My generation, rebellious, anti-establishment, embraced this notion of ordinary folk sacrificed by arrogant toffs for futile ends. The shadow of Vietnam and terrifying nuclear proliferation lay across the politics of my school days, and the narrative neatly fitted the mood and anxieties of the time. The First World War was also seen through the prism of the Second World War and the Holocaust. The justification may have come post facto, but the horrors of the concentration camps gave the 39 to 45 war a moral clarity that could not be so easily discerned through the smog, the fog, and the noxious gases of World War I. As for motivation, well, the medal given to those who served in 1918 said they fought in the Great War for Civilization. Britain was told the huge sacrifice had been made defending basic freedoms, international law, and the rights of small nations against aggression and barbarism. It was, therefore, a moral war, a principled war, a good war. But my generation's understanding of the origins of the conflict was coloured far more by the sentiments of the Kipling couplet from Epitaphs of the War. If any question why we died, tell them because our fathers lied. The implication was that Britain had been duped, tricked and bullied into a war that cost hundreds of thousands of young lives without good cause. The appalling carnage of the First World War then had been founded upon a dodgy dossier of propaganda, a conclusion that left its mark on the conscience of the nation for decades to come. The war came to symbolize, in the minds of some at least, the futility of all such conflicts, that there was no such thing as a good war. The bravery and sacrifice of ordinary servicemen and women was a tragic consequence of, and in contrast to, the glory-seeking and vanity of political and military leaders. The First World War became an argument for pacifism. Not for all, of course. There was a different moral take on the conflict that grew and is still growing, I think, from the memorialization that surrounded the First World War. Really, from the moment the unknown soldier was laid to rest here at Westminster Abbey in 1920, it was about individual valor and collective nationhood. It was about remembrance, about giving thanks for the selflessness of others. It was about flag and country and doing the right thing. This narrative of the First World War contrasted the evil of war with the good of ordinary men and women. Now we look across the poppy fields a full century after the first men fell and reflect anew. 100 years on, in our internet age, conventional thinking about the First World War is being challenged. The Blackadder view of the conflict, summed up by the eponymous hero in the comedy classic as a war which would be a damn sight simpler if we just stayed in England and shot 50,000 of our men a week, that view is under attack. Michael Gove said the First World War may have been a uniquely horrific war, but it was also plainly a just war. He described the Blackadder view of a misbegotten shambles as a myth. Those who fought were not dupes, but conscious believers in king and country committed to defending the Western liberal order, he said. Official plans for the centenary commemoration were criticized by some for failing to put the conflict in the context of aggressive German expansionism. Arguments over whether it was a just war became hot politics. But contemporary analysis has also challenged other myths. Indeed, our dialogue this evening is between two historians whose books strive to question received wisdom. Professor Sir Hugh Strawn's celebrated book, The First World War, has been republished with a new introduction for the commemoration. In it, he writes, "We need to be surprised by what the centenary of the First World War throws up, not to dismiss the uncomfortable and unfamiliar." And Professor David Reynolds' critically acclaimed book, The Long Shadow, The Great War in the 20th Century, invites us to do the same. By reducing the conflict to personal tragedies, however moving, we have lost the big picture. The history has been distilled into poetry, he writes. So, two distinguished voices encouraging us to apply fresh thinking in considering our title tonight. Good War, Bad War, Moral Reflections on 1914 and Beyond. First, if I could invite to the lectern the Chicheley Professor of the History of War and a Fellow of All Souls College, one of the world's foremost experts on the First World War, ladies and gentlemen, Hugh Strawn.
Thank you very much. I'm not going to talk about the causes of the war. Sorry, I'm going to talk about the causes of the war. Good start. I'm not going to talk about the course of the war. But having just heard that introduction, I'm tempted to remark that the debate about British generalship has recently moved to the causes of the war, partly in order to argue that if the war was indeed just and necessary, then that justifies the way it was fought. Let me say for a kickoff, I just think that is arrant nonsense. Clearly, you can go to war for the wrong reasons and fight it well, or alternatively, you can go to war for the right reasons and fight it badly. There isn't necessarily a link between the causes of the war and the way in which it is fought. So having jumped to the end, let me go to the beginning. On Sunday, the 2nd of August, 1914, I took duty, I'm quoting, for the Reverend, not me personally, the Reverend W.R. Baker, Vicar of Hagbourne, Berkshire. On my way to the station about 9 a.m., I looked in at the Oxford Union Society rooms and found the steward posting on the entrance door a telegram that Germany had declared war on Russia. I went back to my rooms to tell my daughter Mildred the grave news. In Hagbourne Church, instead of the sermon I had intended, I mentioned the grave news and spoke for a little on the impending war and the sacrifices it would call for. The church warden thanked me for doing this. Several parishioners had sons in the services, and all would count it a kindness to have received such early intimation that the critical moment had come. That is from the diary of an indefatigable chronicler of the war, the Reverend Andrew Clark, rector of Great Lees in Essex. On the same day, the Archbishop of Canterbury, Randall Davidson, preached here in Westminster Abbey. As the July crisis unfolded, Davidson had refused to endorse a policy of non-intervention, but he had also nurtured the hope that war between Britain and Germany had become inconceivable and that arbitration was the order of the day in the event of European disputes. He said in his sermon, "The thing which is now astir in Europe is not the work of God, but the work of the devil. It is not the development of God's purposes, it is the marring of them by the self-will, the sheer wrongness of man. What is happening must be due somewhere, somehow, I'm not now attempting to judge where or how, to the pride, the high-handedness, the stubbornness of men's temper, undoing and thwarting the handiwork and will of God." In 2003 and since, when this country has debated the rights and wrongs of war, particularly in relation to going to war in Iraq, but also in relation to Afghanistan, which of course has been in our minds in the last day, it has done so through frequent references to the just war tradition, both jus in bello, both how you fight a war, and especially in relation to jus ad bellum, the decision to go to war in the first place. The just war tradition is an ancient one, with intellectual roots in Augustine and St. Thomas Aquinas. And yet what I find striking about 1914, and evidenced by both Andrew Lees and Randall Davidson in their sermons on the 2nd of August, is that the just war tradition was rarely, if ever, cited. Neither of them made any attempt to explain why this war was going on and whether it was justified or not. Europe in 1914 was overwhelmingly Christian, and this was a war, in the first instance, between European peoples. Church attendance in August soared across all the major belligerents. And yet I struggle to find any attempt to justify the war in terms which amount to embracing the jus ad bellum tradition, despite the fact that throughout all the belligerent countries, no clergyman was lost for words to utter from their respective pulpits. In many cases, there is an easy explanation for this absence. All but one of the original belligerents were able to couch this war in terms of national self-defense, in that their own territories had been subject to invasion in the opening weeks of the war. And that was true, of course, even for Germany, which found itself invaded both in East Prussia and in Alsace-Lorraine. The big exception to that generalization was here in Britain. In October 1914, Gilbert Murray, then professor of classics at Oxford, an internationalist, and of course by the end of the war to be a leading force in the League of Nations movement, wrote a pamphlet in the Oxford Faculty of Modern History series, a series that ran to about 80 pamphlets designed to explain why Britain was in this war, called How Can War Ever Be Right? And he wrote in that, our allies had no choice, a reference to the point about self-defense. The war was, in various degrees, forced on all of them. We only, after deliberately surveying the situation, when Germany would have prepared for the moment not to fight us, of our free will declared war. And we were right. So for Britain, at least in Murray's understanding, this was, in today's parlance, a war of choice, not a war of necessity. And yet, despite the aspersions today that we put on that phrase, a war of choice, for Murray, the fact that it was a war of choice, the fact that Britain hadn't been physically invaded, somehow made it morally superior, somehow made the decision a more, if that's not too emotive, sacrificial one to make. What justified that decision? What justified the choice? Even then, few underestimated the costs. I know the cliches that people went to war thinking they'd be back by Christmas and so on and so forth. But I think you also need to recognize how many realized just how weighty this war was about to be and just how long it might last and how heavy the casualties might be. Spencer Wilkinson, the then professor of the history of war at Oxford, wrote a piece in the Morning Post anticipating that war would last 10 years and could cost this country a million lives. He was roughly right on the first point, and of course it was a short war by comparison with his anticipation. The point is, there was not a lack of commentators to point out that the effort required of this war might be disproportionate to the causes of the war. That, in other words, if one of the principles of jus ad bellum is that you try to anticipate whether the costs of going to war outweigh the cause for going to war in the first place, then there seem to be signs that some should have realized that that was a possibility. The collective explanation for Britain's choice, for Britain's deciding that it was worth going into this war, is, of course, the German invasion of Belgium. This was a reason for fighting that made sense of the British decision in strategic, economic, moral, and utilitarian terms. And I say, use all those adjectives, because there is a real sense in which it's not either or. So often the question is put by an undergraduate, did Britain go to war because it felt under a moral obligation to defend Belgium because it was a neutral country, or because it has a strategic interest in making sure there wasn't an overmighty power in the Low Countries? And the answer is, of course, it's not either or, it's both and more besides. Only for Britain was Belgium a crucial issue. The First World War had, after all, begun by then. It had begun before Germany ever went into Belgium in the East, beginning, of course, as a limited war in the Balkans and becoming a more general war when Germany and Russia faced off against each other. For no other of the great powers which had guaranteed Belgian neutrality in 1839 was the invasion of Belgium a reason for fighting. So how did Britain justify its decision in the marketplace of European great ideas? It did so less by reference to any theological or philosophical tradition and more by reference to the nascent, if burgeoning, ideas of international law. The successes of international law in the late 19th and early 20th century had lain in relation to war's conduct, in relation to jus in bello, in relation to how you treated prisoners of war, who was a combatant, who not non-combatant, what their respective rights and privileges might be. There was not much discussion although international lawyers aspired to create a climate in which it would be hard to go to war, there was not much discussion about jus ad bellum. The right to go to war was still vested in the independent sovereignty of the state. Britain argued the 1839 treaty, by which the great powers collectively, not Britain individually, guaranteed Belgium's neutrality, had the status of law. Britain averred it was therefore fighting for the rule of law. At one level, there may be a danger in seeing a legal argument for going to war as distinct from an ethical argument. But the philosophers of the 18th century and their successors would not have accepted that the absence of formal law meant that there was no law. They would have denied that if there is no law on a particular topic, states are permitted to exploit the gap. Instead, they would have said that in the absence of law, there is still natural law. And in the British view, Germany in 1914 had breached natural law. Its conduct, of course, not only in the causes of the war, but confirmed in the immediately succeeding weeks in its conduct of the war in Belgium, meant that it had essentially lapsed from its own position at the apex of civilization to barbarism. That was the crux for many academic commentators, in particular in the autumn of 1914. They could have forgiven an uncivilized state that had behaved as Germany had done. They could not easily forgive what they regarded as a civilized state behaving as it did. Germany should have known better. Nonetheless, Britain's arguments that treaties have a legal quality is surprising on two counts. First, there is the practical issue. In 1914, the Foreign Office had no legal department. Sir Edward Grey, whose Oxford undergraduate career had been spectacular largely for its indolence, had ended up taking a law degree just, and yet Grey had opposed the creation of a legal department and did not, in July 1914, take any legal advice. Grey, in his speech to the House of Commons on the 3rd of August 1914, cited Gladstone's deliberations on the force of the treaty in 1870 during the Franco-Prussian War, and used them to say that this was a matter both of honour, which I understand in this context to mean obligation and even of legal obligation, and of interests, in other words, of foreign policy and strategy. But within days, the press and pamphlet literature had concluded that Britain was fighting for the rule of law in a more literal sense. Alfred Zimmern and others produced a book derived from lectures given to the Workers' Educational Association on the outbreak of the war called Why We Are at War, which argued that international order rested on respect for treaty obligations, and it was these which had created the acme of civilization which pre-war Europe enjoyed. But there was a further thought. In 1789, revolution had given rise to war. One of the purposes of the peacemakers of 1814-15 was to break that relationship between revolution and war, to ensure that international order maintained the domestic status quo. In 1848, revolution had again led to war. But between 1853 and 1904, Europe had largely fought wars without consequent revolutions. In 1904, Russia, of course, experienced revolution as a consequence of war once more. On the 3rd of August 1914, Grey, in his speech to the House of Commons, referred to the force of public opinion in supporting Britain's position and its approach to war. Grey was very far from being a full-blooded Democrat, and he resented the populism of the British media. But on the 3rd of August, he was ready to refer to the wholehearted support of public opinion as justifying where he stood. In the United States, international lawyers saw the project of international law as dependent on democratization. Democracy would create social responsibilities. Herein lay a two-edged argument. On the one hand, for those with vested interests in the international status quo, ostensibly a position which should have attracted the British state given its decline relative to the flourishing industrial state of Germany, treaties could be a means of preventing change, and even of heading off revolution. The lights were, after all, going out over Europe because war could become and could bring revolution, as many, including Grey, recognised, and as indeed happened. But on the other hand, for those progressives looking for reform, both internationally and domestically, there was another argument. A war to uphold treaty law could also become a war for democracy. Germany behaved as it did, not because it was the second largest industrial economy in the world, or because it had the best university system, or because it had the largest socialist party in the world. It behaved as it did because it was a militarist autocracy. The moral purpose of the war was therefore now to set the German people free from their Kaiser, and in due course to set the peoples of the Habsburg Empire free as well. Both ideas, both big ideas, if you like, continue to play out in international relations to this day. In our cleaving, on the one hand, to a rules-based international order designed, if you like, to cement the status quo, and at the same time, in our cleaving to the belief that democratization will generate, eventually, a world without war. Thank you.
Terrific stuff. Thank you very much indeed, Hugh. And now, this is a dialogue, not a debate. But I can't help but notice a certain Oxbridge rivalry tonight. If I could invite to the lectern Professor of International History at Cambridge University and a fellow at Christ College, an award-winning documentary writer and presenter also for the BBC, ladies and gentlemen, David Reynolds.
Well, thank you, Mark. I'm sorry you spoilt that by adopting what I would say is the Radio 4 view of dialogue and debate. Let's see if we can get two people who actually have probably fairly similar views and make them fight it out for the entertainment of the audience of the Today programme for the next 2 minutes to get the people's blood pressure going in the mornings and so on. So Hugh was at Cambridge before he went to Oxford. I mean, he's made mistakes in life, but, you know, he started well, as it were. So, no, thank you very much for your introduction. Because it's a dialogue, we have talked a little bit about how we wanted to approach this and what kind of angles we wanted to explore. And Hugh has talked about the issue of law. I want to make us think a little bit about the people involved and the ethical issues or ethical pressures of making decisions. And there are people here in this audience tonight who make decisions affecting the lives of many hundreds of thousands, millions of people, perhaps. And that's what I want to think about. Because this part of the reason why I think we're puzzled by this war is that its origins are problematic, its course is problematic, and its end is problematic. But we're thinking about origins tonight and the way in which, in the cliche, in 37 days, Europe degenerates from a state of peace to a state of general war, the most civilized, supposedly, part of the world, where people are now tearing each other to pieces. And there have been various explanations for this, but most of them, I think, do not really get to the center of it. There are clearly large structural issues involved. There are questions about military alliances that have formed, arms race, and so on, but I don't think they take us to the heart of the problem. There was a fashion for thinking about this as a problem in domestic politics, that the primacy of domestic politics meant that countries like Germany or Austria were driven to war. Lloyd George famously talked about countries just somehow slithering into war. It sort of happened and we were there. My colleague Chris Clark has used the image of sleepwalking into war. I think none of those really cover what's going on. Part of what makes this such a striking, alarming, perplexing situation is that these men, and they were entirely men, made decisions. Decisions with their eyes open, with a sense, some sense of consequences, and then gradually found that their assumptions about what the consequences would be went seriously wrong. So what we're talking about is an issue of statecraft, an issue of leadership and decision-making. Thomas Otte, in a book, recent book about July 1914, I think has brought that out very well, that statecraft is at the center of this story, not structures, not domestic politics. And so what interests me is, and I want to talk about just for a few minutes, are the men making decisions, and one in particular that Hugh has already talked about, Edward Grey. Grey, I find, a very haunted and haunting figure, because this is a man who handles most of the decisions that lead up to war. He keeps his cards close to his chest as Foreign Secretary. He has the confidence of the Prime Minister Asquith. He's dealing with a cabinet which he knows is mostly full of radicals who are very doubtful about the whole question of going to war. And he doesn't have that much to do with his own officials as well. Yet the consequences of his actions are ones that he, for right or wrong, becomes extremely aware of in later life. I think they live with him for the rest of his life. He lives till 1933, and I'll tell you how he comes to terms with this, I think, in a moment. But it reminds me of a comment that Dwight Eisenhower made, when he was still a general, I think 4- or 5-star general, but it around the time of D-Day, he said one of the hardest things to do is to go along and review troops who are going into battle. You look a man in the eye, and you know, but worse, he knows, that you may well be sending him to his death. And that is a really hard moral decision to make. Perhaps generals are given some kind of training to do it, but politicians, prime ministers, presidents have to do it. And I think all of them, whether we are critical of their particular decisions, live with that sense of burden, moral burden, for the rest of their lives. Grey, I think, is interesting because what he does throughout that period of time is to try and ensure some kind of negotiated settlement of this European crisis that's boiling up. Grey believes in concepts of the concert of Europe. He believes that there ought to be some kind of mechanism and capability for international mediation. The way he handles that approach is open to criticism. The way that he moves from sometimes thinking about a larger meeting of all the major powers to a smaller group and so on. But of course, this is happening over a short period of time, and one has to remember that this is the summer. Many officials, many staff are away. People are expecting their holidays and all the rest of it. That I find also very important, that a lot of the decisions that we as historians can happily criticize later on are made by people who are handling all sorts of crises in their own lives, family, illness, anxiety, desperate need for a vacation or whatever it is. And that is all part of the burden of decision-making close up. Grey's efforts at a mediated settlement, a negotiated settlement, are unsuccessful. The decisions that he takes and he encourages Asquith to take in the last days of, or the beginning of August, leading to those decisions and judgments that Hugh mentioned about taking the country to war over those issues of national self-interest, morality, and law. Those then, I think, play out in the rest of his life, really. It's clear that Gray has something like a breakdown immediately after the war break comes about. I think many of the statesmen who were involved in this do have similar kinds of a sense of crisis. Bethmann Hollweg, the German Chancellor, whose handling of the crisis is pretty inept, certainly comes to a realization later on about, he's haunted by some of the decisions that he took or failed to take. What Gray does, I think, is to channel his sense of guilt, that sense which, as Hugh mentioned, of the old men who had ended up, for whatever reason, sending young men, the next generation, out to die. He channels it into commitment to the League of Nations. The League of Nations is now something of a joke in this country, or at least we think of it as a rather sad failed experiment. This country in the 1920s and 1930s has one of the weakest veterans movements in Europe and North America compared to Germany or France or America, not particularly large and certainly not so politically vociferous. But it has one, in the 1930s, it has the biggest peace movement in Europe by far. And increasingly in the 1930s, the commitment to peace, to ensure that that war of 1418 will indeed be the last war, is seen as the justification, perhaps the only justification, for the sacrifices that have been made in a war which, as Hugh emphasized, we were the only country in which there was not an obvious aspect of territorial aggression. The commitment to the League of Nations is central to Gray's philosophy. He believes it's fundamentally important. That is, if you like, the institutionalized version of the concert of powers that he had hoped to use as a force for mediation in 1914. When those ideas begin to seem utopian in the mid-1930s as Nazi Germany rearms, statesmen take a different view of the lessons of 1914. Two in particular, Neville Chamberlain and Winston Churchill, almost diametrically opposite verdicts on what should have been done in 1914. By then, the view is that the British should not have stayed on the fence for so long. They should have made their position clear. If that line of argument forgets the fact that Gray was in no position to make any position clear because he had no idea whether he had the support of most of the cabinet. But by the middle of the 1930s, the feeling very strongly is that we should start making clear our position. Certainly in 1938, as the Czech crisis looms, Neville Chamberlain is convinced that the British must engage actively in international politics in talking with the German Chancellor. Chamberlain's conception of what we should do is muddled. What he wants to suggest is that Czechoslovakia is not a major issue, but we want to use that as a rewriting of the Versailles Treaty. He is deeply influenced by the legacies of the war, by the loss of his own cousin and younger cousin and close friend Norman, who'd been killed in the trenches. The only book Neville Chamberlain ever wrote was a biography of Norman. Chamberlain is also very conscious of the moral responsibilities he has as a leader. One of the most moving passages in the cabinet records, which are not the records of the minutes of the cabinet, which are not normally very moving, is actually when Chamberlain comes back from his second meeting with Hitler at Godesberg. And in the small plane, he flies up the Thames and he looks down. He tells the cabinet how he looks down over those rows of terraced houses in Deptford and Woolwich and so on. And he asks what he can do as a leader to protect those people, because Britain is naked against the Luftwaffe, as he understands it. So for Chamberlain, the idea is to communicate with the German Chancellor and indicate what we might accept and then what we're willing to accept over Czechoslovakia, and then what we want to do in the future. It's not now, of course, regarded as a very successful policy. But, of course, there are those amazing days just before, just as Chamberlain goes to Munich, and the message that Hitler is willing to have one more conference is passed along the benches over there in the House of Commons, or the old House of Commons, before it was bombed, where the Commons erupts in relief and ecstasy that an act of statesmanship by this leader has actually apparently averted a crisis. And as the Commons erupts in cheers and people throw their order papers in the air, Winston Churchill goes over to Chamberlain. He says, "You were lucky. You were lucky." Because Churchill's view is exactly the opposite, that what you should do, the lesson of 1914, is you show toughness to Germany, you call Germany's bluff, you don't go and talk to the Germans on this kind of issue. You actually take an absolutely firm line. But what I'm trying to suggest is that 1914 does cast this shadow over subsequent thinking. For Grey, the League of Nations. For Chamberlain, the need to do what Grey was not willing to do, come off the fence, but do it in a conciliatory way. From Churchill's point of view, yes, make Britain's position clear, but make it a position of toughness. What I'm struck by in the case of all these leaders is the deep sense of moral seriousness with which they approach this, in ways that we may think are right or may think are wrong now. And those three men, Grey, Chamberlain, and Churchill, are figures that I find quite powerful still, because they convey to me some sense of the burdens of men in power faced by issues of peace or war. We're all faced with moral decisions in our daily lives. I'm now chairman of the history faculty for my sins, and I often think, you know, these are the judgments I make each day are pretty small scale, but I begin to understand a little more about the moral weight of decision making. 1914 illustrates for me the hugeness of the pressures on leaders, and I think that's something we need to bear in mind as well in our reflections on 1914 and beyond. Thank you.